Hi, everybody. Today is October 1st, 2017, and we have wonderful Dr. Alan Frazetti, who is going to talk to us about mindfulness today. I'm going to give you a little bit about what he does. I think everybody kind of knows it, but if you don't, you're going to find out. He is the program director up at McLean Hospital in Boston? Is it Boston?
Belmont, close enough, right next
Belmont.
Door.
Okay, at 3 East Intensive Boys Program, and also the director of the Training and Family Services. He's implemented dialectical behavior therapy for underserved populations and developed many successful DBT programs for people with borderline personality disorder, and other problems with emotion regulation. Research focuses on the connections between severe psychopathology and interpersonal and family processes and their interplay with emotion dysregulation, which we all have in our lives. He is on the board of directors of NEABPD and the International Society for DBT and the Linehan Institute. And he's an author, more than 100 researchers and researches, and clinical papers and book chapters, and lectured and trained professionals in more than a dozen countries, on borderline personality disorder, DPD, and family interventions. He's also a professor at Harvard Medical School. And I'm also going to say that November 11th and 12th, the New York State NAMI convention is in Albany, New York, and Alan is going to be speaking. Is that true?
That is true.
Good. At 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday morning, November 11th, and Matthew and I will be doing a workshop in a little room somewhere in the back at Saturday also at 3 o'clock. So we'll just ask you now, would you like to take... I love you too. Who's
this? so sorry. I didn't know everyone could hear me.
Who is it?
This is Kim Malachy. I was just at the Family Connections Leader Training.
Oh, okay. Well, you're being recorded, so we've already recorded, and we've asked everybody to put their phones on mute, and if you want to interrupt and ask a question while Alan is speaking, you can do that. Is that okay, Alan, or would you rather wait till the very
absolutely.
End?
You're on mute. I'm muting
absolutely.
Now. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Kim, press mute. And okay, so if you have something, questions that you'd like to do, you can unmute and ask the questions. Okay. Alan, you're on.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Anne, for that lovely introduction. And welcome to everybody. And thanks for coming on at least here in Boston is a really lovely Sunday afternoon. So my charge is to talk about mindfulness, I guess for, what do you think, Anne, about 45 minutes and leave some time for questions?
Yes, but our people can also interrupt
ask
you.
During the time, yeah, sure, something
so
like
that.
So
we'll see how far we get.
We have about an hour, right?
Yeah, 5 o'clock we end, yeah.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you know, mindfulness is actually quite a simple thing. And on the other hand, it's extraordinarily complex. So I'm going to try to unpack it step by step, starting with our definition of mindfulness and how we perceive it as a skill, and then how we use our ability to be mindful in the service of not only our own management of ourselves and actually living in the world in a way that is more comfortable, but also as a foundation for being able to live in the social and relationship and family world in a way that's good for other people, and that actually comes back and is good for us as well. So first of all, I think everybody has probably heard the definition of mindfulness that's most common, at least in psychotherapy circles or psychological circles or circles, and that is that mindfulness is being able to pay attention on purpose right now in the present moment without any judgments. And so let me just take that apart a little bit and just make sure we all start from the same place. So mindfulness has an attention component to being able to pay attention on purpose. And the purposeful part is important because, say, you know, you're sitting in your kitchen and an alarm goes off. That alarm pulls our attention. We can then become mindful of it. We can pay attention to it. But that initial moment of attention is actually not mindful. It's automatic. And so when we make our attention purposeful, that's when we start to become more mindful. We're actually making a choice. Skills, all skills from this perspective, create choices. If you have the skill to do something, you have the choice. If you know how to make really good pesto, you have the choice to make pesto and eat it. If you don't know how to make it, you've either got to go buy it or convince somebody you love or who loves you to make it for you. If you know how to drive a car, you have a choice. You can take the bus or walk or ride it or drive the car. If you don't have the skill of driving a car, you don't have that choice. You've got other choices perhaps, but not that particular one. With something as fundamental as mindfulness, it's not so much about having the skill at all, because everybody has some mindfulness skills, but having the skills in the context in which you need them. So, for example, back to driving the car as a skill. Lots of people know how to drive cars, but if you grow up in, say, San Diego or Mexico City, you know, you might not have the same driving skills on ice as people who grow up and learn to drive, say, in Boston or in Minnesota or anywhere in Canada might have, where icy roads are common features half the year, and people learn that skill. So it's not just driving, but being able to drive in what otherwise would be treacherous circumstances, but because people develop skills, they aren't so treacherous. Mindfulness is exactly like that. Everybody can pay attention. Everybody can pay attention to many, many things on purpose right now. But sometimes we have areas, things about our attention that actually trigger us, that actually pull for, they're like an alarm, and they cause an automatic reaction in us that's all automatic and no longer purposeful and therefore no longer as mindful. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. There are loads of things we do on a regular basis that aren't mindful, yet are still perfectly healthy and perfectly safe. So, for example, sleeping. Sleeping is an unmindful activity. We're not being mindful when we're sleeping, yet, you know, we're all trying to sleep many, many hours every night. Similarly, we multitask. You know, we could be planning what we're going to have for breakfast while we're in the shower. And therefore, we're mindful of planning breakfast, but unmindful of taking a shower. That's not bad, because in fact, every time we choose to do one thing mindfully, we're actually choosing not to do the other things we're doing mindfully. So, for example, if you're listening to me right now, and I hope you are, you know, that you've got your attention focused on me, and you're not actually being mindful of, say, sitting in the chair, or mindful of maybe your breath, or mindful of breathing, or mindful of what your present emotion is, or mindful of something that's going on in your house, or something that's going on outside your house, out the window. You're actually paying attention to something else, and so therefore being unmindful of many, many, many other things. So, that's mindfulness, you know, in a nutshell. And the idea is that everybody has some mindfulness skill. And then the questions become, one, how do I get better at this skill to be able to use it in new and perhaps more challenging situations? But also, two, why should I? Why bother? Why does it matter? And so I'm going to kind of go back and forth between the how to get better at this and the why it might be worthwhile. Now, in Family Connections, we've borrowed some of the approaches to learning mindfulness from DBT. And then we've added some of our own, some new ones, in the relationship mindfulness part. So we tend to talk about learning the skill of mindfulness as having a kind of what we're doing when we're being mindful, that paying attention part, and how we're doing it. And what we're doing is we're either bringing our attention, you know, noticing something for the first time. I don't know if other people...
Somebody's not on mute. Can make sure you're on mute because we can hear all that sounds.
Their garbage disposal is audible to all of us.
Yep. Or something. Okay,
yeah, whatever.
Everybody's muting. Okay.
Okay. So when we're... the what we're doing, of course, is we're starting to notice something. So, for example, if you're driving along or taking a bus, you know, at some point you find, you know, that it's time to get off the freeway if you're in the car, or time to get off the bus if it's near your stop, it's at your stop. So when we notice something that cues us, oh, time to take the exit, oh, got to get off here, we're paying attention and boom, just noticing something, just bringing it to our awareness. Or when we, you know, meet someone in our family, the person comes into the kitchen and we just notice the person is actually smiling, looks really happy. I'm noticing that. Or looks really sad. I'm noticing that. I'm observing it. Again, on purpose, bringing my attention to the other person's facial expression, other expressions, and so forth. That's paying attention. That's just noticing, or one way to pay attention. Now, most humans, just because of the way we evolved, have language that quickly, when we notice something, we start to describe it. We start to put words on it. And that's a way to be mindful, is to describe something. So to be able to, you know, look out your window and see a tree and say, I see a tree. Tree is a description. And then you might say what kind of tree it is. Oh, it's an oak tree, or it's a willow tree, or it's a bamboo tree, or, you know, who knows. That's descriptive as well. Or you could say, gee, it's so many meters or so many feet tall, or it's got green leaves, and each leaf is so big, and that's also descriptive. All those things contribute to awareness of the tree. And they're very different than looking at the tree and saying, oh, that's a beautiful tree, or that's an ugly tree, because those are judgments. And so judgments and description are in constant tension, because judgments are putting a kind of good and bad, right and wrong spin on something that we're paying attention to. And description is simply being increasingly aware of the thing we're paying attention to. So if I look out my window and I say I see a plant and it's, you know, it's a meter tall or 3 feet tall, and it's got a purple flower at the top and very sharp pointy things around the flower, I'm being very descriptive. If I say, that's a terrible plant, that's a weed, and you know, well, it may be a weed in the sense that weed could be descriptive, but often weed is a judgmental term, right? We don't call things that we like weeds, right? One person's dandelions are flowers, another person's dandelions are weeds ruining the lawn. And there's no should in that. It's just that they're dandelions. They're a yellow flower with a green stem, and they grow to be so tall and so forth. And they have roots that are a certain depth, and they're rather difficult to pull out. So description and judgment are in constant tension, because judgments are things that we can say fairly quickly that communicate a lot of information, but also can communicate misinformation. Now, nobody's too worried about dandelions, right? If we call dandelions weeds, unless you're a dandelion lover, you're probably used to that, you know. But if that means that somebody's going to come and pull up your dandelions because they're weeds, or your freshly planted saplings of some kind because they think they're weeds, that's different. And, of course, it's not really weeds that are the biggest things here. It's when we start using judgmental words about ourselves or about other people, like, gee, that person's fat. Okay, that's not a word that, at least in most of Western English-speaking world, is descriptive. I lived in the Amazon basin for almost a year once, and there it was actually more of a compliment, because it meant that you had a lot of resources, enough to have enough food. And so saying that somebody was gordo, a little bit chubby, was actually considered a compliment. But if you found a headline in a newspaper that says so-and-so is getting fat, chances are that's actually quite a judgment. It's a negative spin on something that descriptively might mean, gee, this person gained some weight. So now, judgments are problems in relationships because judgments about other people automatically pull for negative emotion when they're negative judgments. And so you have this very efficient mechanism, being judgmental, but at the same time, it's efficient and often takes you well past the information that could be helpful, like that's a weed, to actually hurting another person's feelings, making another person feel defensive, or just getting angry at somebody else because we're judging them. So when we talk about what we're doing, we're trying to be descriptive and not judgmental. And, of course, the other way we can be mindful is simply to stop thinking and just fully participate in an activity. You know, it's not thinking about taking the shower, but just taking a shower fully. Your whole experience is taking a shower. Your whole experience is listening to music or watching a play or eating something that you like the taste of or don't like the taste of. And sometimes the expression is getting lost in the activity. That means that we're not in the third person observing ourselves doing it. We're just doing it. We're engaged in the activity. That's also mindful. Now, so that's what we're doing. We're either noticing, we're describing, or we're engaged unselfconsciously. Those are all ways to be mindful. And, of course, what we're doing, how we're doing it, is we're doing it right now in the present moment. You know, it's right here. We're not worrying about something in the future or in the past, but we're actually paying attention right now. And we're doing it non-judgmentally. And there's this other little caveat that whatever we're doing has to be effective in our lives. So, for example, I could pay attention to what I'm doing. As a therapist, I've had quite a few clients tell me, yes, I did hurt myself, but I did it mindfully. And, of course, that's not possible within the definition of mindfulness because it's not effective in the big picture sense to engage in, say, self-harm. It's not effective. It's not effective in terms of having a really good, high-quality life to harm yourself. So by definition, things that are harmful can't be effective. In the same way that if I'm paying so much attention to, say, cooking my omelet that I don't notice that I started a fire in the kitchen, that's very dangerous. I need to actually pay attention. To be effective means that, oh, I need to notice something else that's more important and pay attention to that sometimes. So that gets us started. We're paying attention on purpose in the present moment and without judgment. Now, that attention piece is pretty interesting because what we pay attention to varies quite a bit. And we could be mindful, for example, of internal experiences, things inside our skin, like our thoughts, our sensations, our emotional reactions, anything that's inside our skin and inside our awareness. Or we could be paying attention to things that are external, the physical world around us, you know, the chair that you're sitting in, the sound of your refrigerator, a tree outside, and so forth. Or it could be people. Not instead of an object, it could be a person. We're noticing, we're describing, we're engaged in interacting with another human being. And so what we're paying attention to could be internal or external. Now, what makes this really complicated is that we talk about it as though this is a kind of linear process. Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a famous expert on mindfulness and has written dozens and dozens of books about mindfulness, he says that, you know, mindfulness is like having a flashlight and shining a flashlight in a very dark room. What the flashlight illuminates is what we're paying attention to. That's the metaphor. We're paying attention to this or we're paying attention to that. And, of course, that doesn't mean that other things aren't there. The things that are in the dark that aren't in our awareness are still present, but the light of our mindfulness is instead focused someplace else. And just like a flashlight in a dark room, if you get close to something, like go up very close to, and you see, oh, this is a dinner table. Say you're in my house and it's completely dark. Say, oh, this is a table. And, oh, look, and it's got a placemat, and there's a napkin and a fork and a plate. Okay, and, oh, let's look at what's on the plate and so forth. You can have a lot of detail up close, but as you do that, you're not at all paying attention to the larger context. For example, maybe this is a surprise party for somebody's birthday. Maybe there are 20 people standing over on the other side of the room in the dark about to say, surprise. Well, that's a very important context thing that could get missed by the paying attention to small details. We can lose the context. But when we notice the larger context, like, oh, it's a surprise party, there are lots of people here, we're also not noticing the details. Each individual person, we're not noticing each person's expression, we're not noticing maybe whether our feet are hot or cold, and whether the table is set for dinner or dessert. You know, so there are all kinds of things that when we do pay attention, we are, again, paying attention to some things and by necessity not paying attention to others. Now, the linearity of this shining the light, is only part of it. And we actually, I think, make a big mistake when we talk about it this way, because it's as though we simply pay attention and we keep paying attention, as though that's easy. But in fact, when we pay attention to something, as soon as it's in our perception, it causes, or I think psychologically the more correct word is, it elicits a reaction. When we notice something, well, we have reactions to it. It's familiar or it's a novel. It seems safe or it seems dangerous. It seems like something we like or it's something we don't like. And those qualities of familiarity versus not being familiar, being safe versus not being so safe, something we like versus something maybe we don't like, those are already very different emotional reactions. And also, when we pay attention to things, it elicits memories and thoughts and so forth. It can make us aware of certain experiences we've had in the past or things we're thinking about in the future. So, in fact, when we pay attention, it's not just like the flashlight. The flashlight is unaffected by the light that it shines, say, on the table, on the dining room table. We are not unaffected. When we shine the light of our mindfulness on something, we see it, we hear it, we smell it, we feel it, we taste it, we respond to it. And now we have a whole new set of things, a whole new set of stimuli internally that were elicited by whatever we were paying attention to externally. Or even if we notice a sensation internally or a thought, oh, I have a thought about something, you know, I just had a thought about, you know, what we're going to do for your birthday next week. And then thinking about that, I have emotion. I have emotion. Oh my gosh, I forgot I was going to order this, or I was going to make a reservation, or oh, I just remembered how sad I was that, you know what, you didn't remember my birthday last year, and I was really upset by that. And so now I'm thinking about spitefully, even though I'm remembering maybe spitefully, I won't do anything for you this year. So that light of mindfulness that we shine out and pay attention to something actually doesn't just keep going. It feeds back to us. Our attention goes out to an object on the outside of us or another person or something outside of us or to a memory or a thought or an emotion or a sensation. And then that, whatever that elicits, whatever our reaction is there alongside with the thing that we're paying attention to. So we now have to decide, do we keep paying attention to this thing we're paying attention to and simply allow our reactions to come and go as they please, or am I going to get sidetracked from what I was paying attention to and instead I'm going to indulge my reaction? And of course, there's no right answer in advance. We have to decide that when the time comes. You know, as you're driving along and paying attention to driving, that's really skillful. It's really being mindful. You're paying attention to, you know, staying in your lane, and you're checking your mirrors, and you know, you're driving in a very safe way, and you're noticing that there's a light that just turned red up ahead, so you're starting to slow down. All that's really good. But what if, you know, as you're driving along, you pass on the other side of the road, you see a car crashed into a telephone pole, and it's a car that belongs to somebody you know. Well, that's going to have a big reaction. Do we just keep slowing down into the red light and then continue to pay attention to driving? Or do we, that's really hard to do. Maybe we decide to pull over, safely, I hope, but pull over and then see if we can assist, or pull over and call 911, or something else. The idea is that what we pay attention to can have a big impact on our ability to be mindful. Now, anybody in that situation seeing a car crash, even if we didn't know, recognize the person's car, anybody would have probably a big reaction. Remember I said at the beginning, a big alarm pulls our attention, and then we have a choice whether to continue to pay attention. So a big stimulus like seeing a car crash, there's almost no way to avoid that, but then we have the choice to decide if we're good at mindfulness. Oh, you know, I don't recognize that car. There's an ambulance there. There's a fire truck there. I can't help there. Everything that's needed is already there. So I'm going to pay attention to driving safely here and not pay attention to the poor person who's in this car crash and pay attention to the crashed car and all the first responders and so forth. But that requires a lot of mindfulness skill, being able to take our attention away from something that's screaming at us. Alarm, alarm, there's a car crash, it's terrible, it's awful, some poor person is really hurt. To be able to actually bring our attention back to checking our mirrors, staying in our lane, driving safely, pulling through to a gentle stop at a red light, and moving forward in the green light. Now, let me just stop for just a second, because I just want to see if anybody, I've been talking now for a while, I want to see if anybody has any questions so far.
Hi, my name's Kathy. Can you hear me?
Hi, Kathy. Yes.
So at the tail end of this, because we are thinking in mind of our family and loved ones who struggle with the borderline, when you say you have a choice then based on having these reactions, I was thinking of your trans model of vulnerabilities.
Yep. Right.
I guess now I'm asking the big question is, do you always have a choice? Does your subconscious sometimes take over and you respond without even knowing? I mean, do we really always have a choice when we react? And
that's our kiddos,
like, do they?
Yep.
Sometimes they just can't help it.
Well, that's a really good question. If we have the skill, then we have the choice. If we don't have the skill, it could be completely automatic and we could get sucked in completely and not have a choice at all. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes.
Think about it as, you know, like driving, and then you start to skid a little bit on ice. If you're a skilled driver on ice, you automatically turn into the skid, take your foot off the gas, you might pump your brake gently. Actually, newer cars do that for you, but, you know, and, you know, if you have the skill, you have less of a reaction. You actually notice that skid so early before you're actually fishtailing that you're actually never in any danger because, you know, you've got the skill to drive safely on ice. But if you've never done it before, you don't notice it until you start fishtailing, and then you might panic. And what most people do who've never done it before is they actually turn the steering wheel in the wrong direction and then turn the car completely around in a 360. And so, you know, now I would never say that person's choosing to crash into the guardrail or choosing to turn the car or do a complete circle in the car on the ice. I would say the person didn't have the skill to manage driving in that situation. And that's mindfulness plus all the other skills. And so I think you're right. So our loved ones who have BPD, this is why, of course, we call mindfulness the core skill. They, of course, need to learn mindfulness in a lot of different situations to be able to slow their reactivity down, to be able to build the choice to do something different. And we need to practice mindfulness so that our reactions to their reactions don't spin us completely out of control either.
Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Oh, good. Yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah, hi, Alan. It's Michelle speaking.
Hi.
I have a question about participating fully.
Yep.
I've always been confused by the fact that on the one hand, with observe and describe, you're sort of slowing yourself down and not becoming fully involved and being mindful of what's happening, sort of in a third-person observer stance. And then with participating fully, you're totally throwing yourself into it.
That's right.
Can you just sort of comment on that dialectic? Because it seems to me almost counterintuitive that participating fully should be part of mindfulness.
Right. It seems counterintuitive that it would be. It seems almost mindless, right? But
right.
In fact, our full attention, we can, when we choose to throw ourselves into something, then we're fully participating. Now, to be honest with you, again, I think we're a little bit misleading because if we're really being effective, it's only 99.9% fully. There's still that little tiny, what I sometimes call a semi-permeable membrane of attention, that if something else were really important, say dangerous,
right,
that we would be able to become aware of it, and that we would pay enough attention to that we would leave the full participation in whatever we were doing and do that instead.
So in a sense, that's what makes it mindful, because we're not 1,000% in?
It's not a full 100%. It's only 99.9. Yeah, exactly. So if we were, I agree with you, that we'd actually go so far the other direction, it would become unmindful. In the same way that if you're so observing and describing of one thing that you're 100% there, you could miss the context.
Right. So let's say, I mean, in terms of distress tolerance, so there you would fully participate in, let's say, watching the movie or reading the book, and you really would be mindless because you'd be totally somewhere else. Would that
be
correct?
If you were doing it in a reactive sort of way,
mm-hmm,
right, a kind of escaping kind of way.
Right, exactly.
Right? Then that would
right.
be mindless. But that's why things are rarely 100% mindless, right?
Okay.
Like, for example, you know, deciding to, in the summer, you know, take whatever your guilty pleasure novel is for you and take it to the beach or to the pool and read for a couple of hours this completely guilty pleasure, you know, you kind of escape into it. That could be a very mindful choice, right? You're choosing to escape. You know, I've got a lot of things to do. I've got a lot of things on my mind. But I you know what? I want a break from that. And actually choosing a skillful way to have a break from that is very mindful.
So the choice then would be mindful, but once you're inside that book, you're sort of more mindless.
Well, I would say you're actually being very mindful of the book, as long, and that is mindful as long as that choice was an effective choice.
Okay. Okay. And then how would you use that? I mean, as a skill, how would that?
Well, I think what happens is sometimes, you know, as, let's say, as parents or partners of people who are suffering, sometimes we feel like we have to pay all of our attention to the person who's suffering. And we can throw ourselves into being really good caregivers. And then if we're out of balance, we realize we may not be taking care of ourselves. And then that becomes an even though we're paying a lot of attention to our loved one, it actually, in the long run, is not good for that other person or for us, because we might just burn out.
Right.
And then we have nothing left to give. That's bad for us, and it's bad for the other person, because there's nothing left to give, nothing less for the other person in terms of our help. We've kind of lost it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. Okay,
great.
Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Hey, Alan, it's Marie Paul. Can I add a quick something to the the gentleman who just asked this question? The usefulness of mindfulness, I can speak to that like firsthand. You know, there are moments when we interact with our loved ones, and, you know, years of habit, years of responding a certain way, and that way is not really effective, right? Mindfulness is sort of the only way we have as parents to label what we're just about to do, that we've done a million times, and it's not worked for a million times, and to say, all right, but there's this other skill that I've learned. There's this other choice I have. I can act different. I can radically accept instead of try to push. Or, you know, so to me, mindfulness is so core for that. If we're not mindful of what we're about to do, then we're going to do the same thing again and again.
It just becomes automatic, unmindfully automatic.
Exactly.
Right, which is, you know, again, a more benign example is if you, say, move, you change jobs, and you've been working at the same job for many years, you hop in your car or you hop on the bus going in a particular direction, and you realize, oh, wait a minute, I don't work there anymore. I just, you know, you had so much practice, it's an automatic behavior. Now, that actually was a perfectly skillful thing to do last year when you worked at the old place. Having to think about it wasn't necessary, but now it is, because there's a change. And having the ability to remember where you're going is really important when the automatic isn't working anymore. And that's why, you know, for parents in particular, I would say, it gets tricky, because you might have one child where, you know, your automatic ways of soothing, say, work really well. And you think, okay, I got this down. You know, I just pay attention. I'm a good parent. I love my child. And all the things that I do, or at least enough of them, are effective. But then you have another child, and those same things just don't have the same impact. And it can be very confusing. A little bit like going to a country where you don't speak the language, and people often just start to speak their own native language louder, but people don't understand it. It doesn't actually, speaking it louder does not help them understand. Learning their language is the thing that's going to get us what we want and be helpful to the other people. And I think that's the hardest part, because, gee, this ought to work. We think this ought to work. And that's the judgment that gets in the way. Because, of course, how could it work? You know, one child likes to be soothed, another one doesn't, you know.
So you just said at the end, the judgment statement was, this is a lot of work. Because I have a hard time.
It ought to work. It ought to work.
Judgment? But you switched it to, this is going to be work?
Well, no, I say, you know, it shouldn't work. There's no should. I would simply describe it to, what I'm doing isn't working. Now I can try something different. If I know what I'm doing isn't working, well, I can try something different. Instead of saying, what I'm doing should work, and so I keep doing it.
I see. Thank you.
You know, it's like when I went to get on my computer, this just happened an hour ago, you know, and I type in my password, and it doesn't work, you know. And I said to myself, no, that is my password. This should work. But in fact, of course, I was not typing my password. I was, I think the caps were on or something, and I wasn't typing my password. So, you know, of course, I'm not typing my password, therefore it shouldn't work. Of course it shouldn't work. Okay. Now, the questions were perfect because that's exactly the direction I wanted to move here for the last part, which is to take these same principles and think about, like, what are the things that when we pay attention, when we shine the light of our attention in the direction of another person, what are the things that elicit a big enough reaction in us that we stop paying attention? Because that's the thing that's getting in the way of our ability to be mindful. Right? So, for example, if I'm trying to pay attention to one of my kids and I get judgmental, I think, oh, he shouldn't talk that way to me. Well, now that's getting enough emotion going in me that I'm no longer really listening and paying attention. I've lost my curiosity, because if I had enough curiosity, there's something going on there that I probably could notice, which doesn't necessarily make him being, you know, whatever he said, doesn't make it okay, but it helps me to understand it. My curiosity, when it's lost, means that my attention is getting narrow. And if I lose my kindness, which is often associated with curiosity, because curiosity is kind of an open emotion and brings with it a kind of an acceptance, it's like an interest in things, but now it's like, he shouldn't have said that, he shouldn't talk to me that way. That's not only is my attention getting smaller, but my attention is getting bigger in response to my reaction instead of my child. And whatever I was doing before, which if I were curious and kind, might help him to slow down and be more accurate in his expression, instead, now I'm communicating annoyance, judgment, anger. He perceives that, and actually he's going to react to that, which is probably actually not going to help him do the next skillful thing. So where mindfulness breaks down, relationship mindfulness breaks down. And where relationship mindfulness breaks down, we're at now high risk of becoming invalidating, or at least not listening, which eventually becomes invalidating, which at least gets in the way of the other person expressing him or herself accurately. So mindfulness as the core skill is what we need to do, and a lack of mindfulness is kind of like the beginning of the end. It's like, oh, now we're going to crash. The whole thing's going to fall apart, at least briefly. We can always put it back together again, but at least for this round, it's going to fall apart. So I guess my question for you is, just if you think about like one instance where things just didn't go well, where was the first mindfulness step failure, the first moment where your real attention on the other person took a dramatic turn and you started paying attention to your own reaction instead, either an emotion or thought or a memory or a judgment, like shouldn't do that or what a jerk or something like that? Anybody have an example?
This is Deborah.
Hi.
Hi. I have an example just of last week with my daughter. I think what it is what I'm particularly sensitive to.
Mm-hmm.
If I perceive criticism coming from my daughter,
mm-hmm.
She's my loved one, I immediately start having internal negative emotions, and yes, that judgmentalness, and then I shut down.
Got it. So I would say, let me slow you down for just a second, because you just said a whole bunch of things quickly that are all very important. I don't think it's your sensitivity that's where you're going off, because I think you could be sensitive and not like it,
right,
and
right.
still be able to bring your attention and your curiosity and your kindness to it.
Uh-huh.
I think it's either your reactivity, either when you are, because you're sensitive, you pick it up, which is not a bad thing at all. but it's because you pick it up and get big with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
And so
I
it's either
my, I feel my
either
blood
a,
pressure going up.
That's right. So either it's a big automatic reaction,
yes,
or you get judgmental of it that makes it big.
Uh huh.
Do you have a sense of which it is? By the way, I think I'm speaking for everybody that you are not alone in this.
Yes. Gosh, is it judgmentalness, you said, or just kind of this automatic reaction?
Kind of a big automatic reaction.
Reaction.
Yeah. And
Ooh.
It could be both. I mean, you know.
Yeah, yes.
They could beat each other.
I think the judgmentalness, because I'm thinking, why is she criticizing me about this?
Yeah, which is, of course, not a real question.
Yes. Right.
Right? That's
right.
A euphemism for she shouldn't be doing this.
Yes.
How dare her?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Of course. Well, welcome to the species. You know, this is what people do. Right. So if you want, and this is entirely up to you because it's a skill, just like any skill, just because you have it doesn't mean you have to use it, right? Just because I could ride my bicycle doesn't mean I can't take the bus or drive my car, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you had the mindfulness skill, then you could turn that euphemistic question into a real question, like, you know, I don't really like her talking to me this way. I wonder why.
Mm-hmm.
What's making her do this right now? And then you have a little bit more awareness. There's kind of an opening of your awareness instead of a closing down, and then you can kind of in a kind of more penetrating way pay attention to her and like, what's the matter? You can be asking yourself or even ask her.
Yes,
which of
and
course itself is a validating thing to do. But go ahead.
And that's interesting because she in the end she told me later on that she's very anxious. And that was, so she, she was able to discover that after this kind of, negative type of interchange. But she said, I think what she said was, I'm really not a bad person, Mom. I was just very anxious.
Huh. Well, I mean, and to which you said what? What did you say in response?
I said, yeah, I know that. I know that your intentions are good. And,
great.
And I said, I appreciate you telling me that.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
But what's interesting is that, I wasn't being mindful, but she was able to be mindful, a little, after some time passed,
Mm-hmm. Right. And I would say you did that because you're able to do that because you actually know you allowed your curiosity and your mindfulness skill to get big, instead of your attention to your reaction to get big.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? You're paying attention to your I don't like it part,
right?
And then working on like, oh, because I don't like it, she shouldn't do it, Instead of, I don't like it, I love her, and I wonder why she's doing this, because she's I'm sure, a lovely person, at least at times, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yep, exactly. Is this helpful to folks? Does this make sense?
Very helpful.
Okay. Very helpful. So I think if we take an example like this, we all have them on a kind of regular basis, I imagine. I think it's very helpful to go backwards, and part of our practice can be, let's slow it down. Let me notice where did my attention go from being at least 51% on the other person to now being primarily on not liking something about the other person, because the not liking means that we're paying attention to our reaction, right? So if I'm eating a bowl of ice cream, right? Remember in that I said it's actually a more of a cycle than a linear thing, right? So I take a bite, and then I taste it. I'm having a reaction. Now it doesn't make sense while I'm tasting that to have four more bites. It makes much more sense to let the sensations of the bite go away and then bring my attention back to the ice cream. Okay? And that's actually just like a relationship in a way. When we like it, just enjoy it and keep our attention there. The ice cream, of course, is in our mouth. But the other person's activity is in our hearts or in our minds. We're paying attention to it. Our reaction is part of the attention instead of we're leaving our attention, taking it from the other person and putting it entirely onto our reaction. Does that make sense? Otherwise, the old bowl of ice cream is gone and we didn't taste it. Okay, so if you kind of go slowly through this conversation that didn't go well, say, then you say, now where did I start to pay more attention to not liking it, being upset, and less attention to, less curiosity, less interest, less openness, less relationship mindfulness. And that's the place, there's no requirement, but if desired, that's the place to work on, how could I tolerate better that reaction and now bring my attention back to the other person in a non-judgmental way, in an open, curious way that maybe even pulls a little bit of love and kindness with it, so that I'm communicating openness and caring instead of how dare you.
So it sounds like this is Kathy, that we're practicing what we're asking them to do.
Exactly.
Because they can't regulate, and a lot of our loved ones have these emotional reactions, and we're just going, why are you this and why are you that in our heads?
Mm-hmm.
Have to also be mindful to realize when we interact with them, we're constantly having emotional reactions as well. And we
That's
have
exactly right.
Either stay curious or be judgmental, and we're kind of doing what we're asking them to do, right?
That's exactly right. But the difference might, here's where it gets tricky, though, I think, because it's like with somebody who's a middle-aged driver, you know, who's driving in front of you, if that person is not doing a good job staying in lane on a dry road, on a warm day, okay, there's no ice anywhere, right? It's easy to get judgmental of that, right? But we have to recognize that that person doesn't have the skill to do whatever he or she needs to do. That person is either not being mindful of driving, but that's because, you know, maybe he or she's having a heart attack, right? Or there's a bee in the car, you know, who knows why, or is just a beginner driver, even though he or she is, you know, middle-aged, just is actually just a student driver. In the same way that if we were on an icy road, right, we give the person in front of us, as soon as we're aware it's icy, we actually give the person in front of us more space. So when they do swerve a little bit, we don't get as judgmental if they swerve just a little bit. Then we get judgmental if they swerve a lot and flip around. Right? We think they should be a better driver. And so that's what happens. It's like we could be good drivers, but in the slippery zone of the relationship with a loved one, you know, it's like having, you know, I think what we around here call black ice, you know, it's, you can't see it, you know, it's in the pavement and it's not really visible. And so unless you're very skilled and very aware, it's very easy to slide on it. And people aren't that judgmental when you do, because it's so easy to do. But it's still, like, if we're really good at it, and if we live someplace where there's a lot of that, it's probably effective to get really good at it. We could probably avoid a lot of car crashes.
Oh, I really appreciate that, because that's, I think, as parents and family members, is how do you, a skill we can use to not be judgmental. It's really hard. And I just love this phrase, always give them space.
Give them space, exactly. Right. It's like if they swerve a little, instead of like, you shouldn't do that, that's not safe, that's terrible, it's like, all right, you're learning to drive. Like, what just happened? What's going on? and how can I help? Chastising really never helped anybody regulate their emotion. You could quote me on that one.
Hi. I'd like to, make a comment, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
You can expand upon it. This is, my name is Eileen McDaniel. I'm in Sierra Madre in California. And I was just listening to what you said about, or you asked the question, when did we stop being mindful of the other person and then become mindful of our own emotions?
Right, primarily mindful of our own, right.
And I'm just thinking about how that intersects with validation and how when we stop being mindful of them and become more mindful of our own reactions and emotions, we're less able to validate. Does that make
sense?
That's
right. That's exactly right. Because we're no longer able to understand their behavior, because all we know is that we don't like it, that it's hurtful to us, we've stopped bringing curiosity. And without the curiosity, we can't understand the other person's experience. And if we don't understand the other person's experience, we can't possibly validate.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Alan?
Yes.
This is Doreen.
Hi, Doreen.
I just wanted to give an example of what she was just saying. So my daughter was a cutter, and I was a nurse. And so at first when I discovered it, I was very judgmental. You know, like, how could you do that to yourself? Like, what are you thinking? Don't you know you can be infected? And totally was missing the emotional part. And even when I tried to lose the judgment after I started learning skills, I would say, you know, well, did you clean it? You know, I try not to be judgmental, but I found that was also not helpful. And so finally, I had to stop and look at my own reaction again when learning these skills. And now she doesn't do it anymore, but I started to, when she would tell me I cut last night or something, I would just stop, check my own emotions, try to be mindful. I said, well, that must have been, you must have been really having a hard time. I'm so sorry that you had such a rough night. And it totally changed the conversation. So it was huge, you know, for her to be able to talk to me about it and then for me to lose my own judgment. But it does take a while. It is a skill that is really difficult to practice.
And oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah. The other example you brought up is about, you know, the disrespect, and that was a huge one too. I think when our loved ones are screaming at us and calling us names and everything, it is really hard, and that's not acceptable. But in the moment, it's important to stop your own reaction and just say, well, they must be really dysregulated, like, you know, go into the whole description. That has totally changed my responses to my daughter too. Again, much better now, but in those tough times, it was a very important skill to have for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. Those are such good examples, you know. And then the idea, of course, is let's not beat ourselves up for not having that skill. We haven't practiced it enough, and it requires an enormous amount of compassion, and I think practicality to practice it. But I think when we practice it, just like driving on ice, we can get good at it. And then the person who's driving, you know, if you do this, sorry, my apologies to people in the Sun Belt for whom this example may be overdone now. But, you know, but for those of us who have to encounter this, when you do give people room, you have, you know, it's like then they can learn to do what they need to do too without us crashing. Because, you know, people are not all individually, you know, great at these things. And, you know, some people get more practice. And then it's just safer for us, and it affords the opportunity for other people to get better at it too.
Okay, it's 5 o'clock, Alan.
Oh, time flies.
Time flies. But that's something that we tell our family members for doing mindfulness is to practice.
Absolutely.
Practice at the grocery store, practice with your neighbors, practice with little kids, just keep practicing. I teach up in a school, and I just pay attention. And mostly I just listen. I listen, and I don't make any judgments. But So thank you. I mean, okay. We should maybe put part B of this in the summertime because it can go on. It's wonderful. I want to mention that November 19th is going to be Meshulam Gottlieb, who's right there. Hi, Meshulam, right?
Hi, I'm right here.
Yeah.
I'm right here.
And it will be at 3 p.m. because poor Meshulam is probably the middle of the night for him. And so we're going to give him an extra hour. So November 19th, and he's going to talk about Module 6 notes, which many of us have different ones, so we can add to that. And thank you so much, Alan.
Oh, you're very welcome. And thank you all for joining. I hope this is just a little bit helpful, and keep up the great work.
Yeah,
thank you. It's always helpful. Thank you.
Okay, okay. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Have a
Take care.
Week.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Alan.